this is unremarkable. These are some of the terms that he uses.
If it was so unremarkable, it would have been 7-2, but it was not.
Right. Exactly. Welcome to Respecting Religion, a BJC podcast series where we talk about what's at stake for faith, freedom for all in 2020. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC.
And I'm General Counsel Holly Holman. Today we're going to discuss the Supreme Court's June 30th decision in Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue, a case that has major implications in debates about funding education and protecting against government-sponsored religion. Hi, Amanda. It's good to be back with you after our 4th of July break.
Yeah, great to be with you, Holly. How did you spend your 4th this year?
It was different, and then we did not venture out to the mall to see the nation's fireworks. And in fact, felt like a very old person in, not that there's anything wrong with it, and watching that firework display on TV. We watched a little bit and then out in the neighborhood walked around where people were putting off some suburban fireworks. But it was nice to have an extra day off and enjoyed that.
If it makes you feel better, I have been known to watch the fireworks on TV even when we weren't living in a pandemic. This year, I didn't even do that. I could just hear the fireworks going off about a mile from my apartment. But we had a 4th of July at home, one like none other. And something else that's happening in July that usually doesn't happen is we're still getting cases from the Supreme Court. Supreme Court hasn't gone on their summer break yet. And we were waiting a long time for this decision in Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. I'm glad that we're having the conversation. I'm glad that we've had a few days to process the decision because there's really a lot here.
That's right. The case was argued way back in January when we were still having oral arguments in the courtroom. And I was in that crowded courtroom back in January, sitting very close, not even 6 inches, much less 6 feet from strangers. And yeah, we've been waiting for this case for a while. It's a case that BJC filed a brief in, working with Professor Stephen Green, who's an expert. We'll talk about his work in a little bit. And we were joined by our good friends from other denominational entities from the United Church of Christ, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and the Presbyterian Church USA. And we were eager to try to have an influence in this case and to see how the court would resolve it after very aggressive and thorough, interesting oral arguments in the case.
Yeah. So we're going to talk all about the case. I did want to say right up front that our listeners, and we'll put a link in the show notes, but we do have a page on our website that's dedicated to this case. It's bjconline.org/Espinoza. So people who want to have some background information can definitely go there. There's also a lot more background information on this case on the Respecting Religion podcast series. Our second episode in this series was devoted to this case and analysis of the oral argument and background and some of the issues involved. We recorded that way back in February. What a different time that was. Nostalgic for that pre-pandemic time when we sat in the same room and recorded episodes and talked about cases that you attended in person, Holly. But would just say for our listeners who want to get some information, you might want to go back and listen to episode 2.
Yeah, I'd say just a real quick reminder, BJC's perspective in the case, as I said, Jennifer Hawks, Associate General Counsel for BJC, and I worked very closely with Steve Green on it. And our brief really focused on two issues: the distinctive role of religion in our constitutional order, in the First Amendment and in state constitutions, and the history of the no aid principle. So that was the focus of our brief.
Yeah. And just a quick thumbnail of what the case was about. This was a case that was brought under the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. It was a case brought by parents of private religious school students. And the central issue in the case was whether the Free Exercise Clause precludes Montana from applying its constitution to bar religious schools from a scholarship program. And Montana had a very particular legislative program that basically incentivized contributions to private schools. It is beyond just a usual charitable deduction to nonprofit schools. It is actually a dollar for dollar tax credit, albeit small here, $150 for donations to a scholarship program. And that program was at odds with a provision in the Montana state constitution called a no aid provision that precluded state aid in any form, direct or indirect, going to benefit religious schools.
That's right. And as we heard at oral argument, in order to decide this case, the court really had to grapple with questions about religious freedom and these bans on aid to religious schools and what they're for. And for a lot of people who just think generally about religious liberty being protected by the separation of church and state, you just think, okay, doesn't the Constitution prevent money from going to religious institutions? But the question here was quite specific, as you outlined there, Amanda, about Montana's state constitution and what it prohibited. So we have kind of different standards at the federal level in the federal constitution and in state constitutions.
Yeah, and like a case that this case built upon, Trinity Lutheran, there are issues, as you note here, of federalism, of what states can do and whether states can go above and beyond what the Establishment Clause has been held to require when it comes to preventing aid going to religious institutions or, as we'll get into in a little bit, religious uses of the money as well. So like Trinity Lutheran, which is a case we also give quite a bit of background on in episode 2, Chief Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion in this case, as he did in Trinity Lutheran, but this time for a smaller majority. Trinity Lutheran was a 7-2 decision. This was a 5-4 decision. And much of the opinion from Chief Justice Roberts reads as it's kind of his style of judicial restraint, as this is just a natural following from that prior opinion. Of course, how could we decide something else? This is unremarkable. These are some of the terms that he uses. And in doing so, as again, I think we'll focus on a little bit more, he focuses on the religious status or character.
Yeah, if it was so unremarkable, it would have been 7-2, but it was not.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And there were quite a few dissenting opinions in this case, so that did find it more remarkable than he did. But that's just kind of his style, you know, from when he was first confirmed as a justice, that, you know, his job is just to call balls and strikes. And so he really tried to put his opinion into a format that this just naturally followed from a precedent that's just 3 years old.
Listeners may want to go back and review more about Trinity Lutheran. We have a page dedicated to that as well on our website, but that's the church playground case where, again, a state constitution was at issue. And there it was about a grant program that would provide money to help playgrounds be refurbished with recycled tires. So if a church participated, it would be direct government money to a church. And so similarly, the state had excluded the church, a religious entity there, again, to protect against government funding of religion. But the court said, hey, this is totally secular aid, and did not honor, in that case, Missouri's constitution. But in doing so, plurality had said that that was about playground refurbishing material, secular use, and that the court was not saying anything about religious use. And so now this case comes to the Supreme Court with the tax credit program, scholarship money that would go to religious schools for religious education. The bottom line for the majority was that the Montana Constitution discriminates based on religious status, just like the Missouri policy in Trinity Lutheran. So it's a holding that the Free Exercise Clause prohibits that kind of distinction, that in fact is religious discrimination against religion, against religious entities based upon their religious status.
And as disturbing as that bottom line is for us and is lacking of nuance, I think, to the First Amendment, as we'll get into when we get to the dissents, I have to be at least a little encouraged after I read the concurring opinions that it could have been much worse. There were other justices in the majority who would have gone much farther if they had been writing for a court's majority. For instance, Justice Thomas, who was joined in his opinion, concurring opinion by Justice Gorsuch, challenged the core meaning of the Establishment Clause, rejected most of the court's prior jurisprudence on it, and said it doesn't even apply to the states. So there are two votes on the court for that pretty extreme position that would read the Establishment Clause out of religious freedom cases pretty much entirely.
I think it is pretty clear from this decision that the five justices in the majority don't think much about the Establishment Clause and what it takes to comply with the Establishment Clause. You're right, Justice Thomas has sort of been in his own realm in that view, in that he says, frankly, that the Establishment Clause does not mean what the court has said through the years, and he would allow much more government support for religion, preference for religion, and now he has company with Justice Gorsuch, even on this idea that the Establishment Clause should not apply to the states, which, you know, it's been a lonely perspective that Justice Thomas has been writing in dissents and concurrences for many years, and now he has a little company there. So that is a more extreme view than the majority noted. And then Justice Alito wrote a separate concurrence, and I was very happy that his views did not appear in the majority opinion, but it was pretty disturbing that he took many pages to put forth this idea that no aid provisions were based, in his view, on the idea of bigotry toward religion, anti-Catholic sentiment, totally ignoring the fact that the no aid principle predates, you know, the immigration of many Catholics and any debates where anti-Catholic sentiments were prominent. He leaves that part of the history out and then just really puts forward this very ugly picture of no aid that was served up to the court in many of the amicus briefs, just repeating over and over this idea that the no aid principle is somehow tainted because it was used by people who had very ugly anti-Catholic views during debates over the assimilation of immigrant communities, the development of a public school system, the funding of state initiatives for school. So a very complex history that we talked about in our brief, relying on Professor Stephen Green, who is the nation's expert in this area, was reduced to this very narrow history.
Yeah. And not only did he ignore that history from the founding, he ignored subsequent history from 1972 when the state of Montana reaffirmed their no aid provision and had a broad variety of religious voices who spoke in support of no aid provision and the principles that also undergird the Establishment Clause. But the no aid for religion is good for religious liberty. And, you know, just a side note here, there's so much going on in these opinions. But court watchers were interested to see how Justice Alito would deal with this subsequent history from the 70s, because in another case this term, the Ramos case, he had said in that case that later adoption or readoption of a provision that perhaps was tainted by discriminatory intent at the beginning, that if it was readopted and had a benign intent, that would save the provision and that it would not have to be invalidated for a discriminatory purpose. So basically, his view in Ramos was absolutely antithetical to his view in this case. And so people were wondering, how is he going to deal with that? And I thought he dealt with it in a very curious way. He lost in the Ramos case, and so he cited the majority opinion to say, well, clearly that Ramos holds here. He doesn't even bother to explain why his view was so different in this case than it was in a case that he had written on just a couple of months ago.
I'll show you, court, and you think the history was bad there. Look at the history here. And I think that that's pretty offensive because he ignores the earlier history that provides a religious liberty reason for the no aid rule and sort of doubles down on this story as if it is the historical record. And then he ends his opinion with a swipe at the public schools, which feels very unnecessary, by saying that, you know, while today's public schools may be very different from how they were envisioned earlier, that still many parents of different faiths still believe that their local schools inculcate a worldview that is antithetical to what they teach at home. And many have turned to religious schools at considerable expense. And so he's laying the ground for this need to fund religious schools. And he's doing that, you know, by attacking the public schools, which we know and often work hard to ensure. Public schools serve students of every religion and every ethnicity, and they do so at great pains to make sure that all are welcome and that individual religious freedom is respected. And yet the government is very careful, the public school teachers and administration, to not advance religion that would obviously harm the individual religious liberty of this diverse student body in the public schools.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk through the dissents and some additional analysis of this landmark case.
Well, as we mentioned, it was a 5-4 decision, so we should talk a little bit about the dissenting opinions. They really showed the complexity of this case in that they really addressed different things. First of all, Justice Ginsburg, joined by Justice Kagan, filed a dissent and really chastised the court for even deciding this case. By the time the case came to the Supreme Court, there was no longer a tax credit program in Montana, and so there was no differential treatment. So that was a strong dissent based on those procedural grounds. And then Justice Breyer filed a dissent, and Justice Sotomayor filed a dissent. They both engaged more directly with the issue and the tension between preventing discrimination based upon religious status on the one hand, but also allowing governments to stay out of essential religious activity like religious education.
Yeah, and I mean, just from the opening paragraph of Justice Breyer's opinion, I was so pleased. After reading a lot of opinions that really had no use or mention of Establishment Clause principles, to see him standing up for a view of the First Amendment where both clauses protect religious freedom. And as he says, taken together, the religion clauses have helped our nation avoid religiously based discord while securing liberty for those of all faiths. So to see that basic principle that I don't think we've taken it for granted, but we've certainly thought that there was widespread support for that for so many years. To see that now in a dissenting opinion is dispiriting. But at the same time, I thought that his opinion really engaged in a nuanced and interesting way about how these two clauses work together, and that this kind of active engagement, not just kind of a one-size-fits-all test or a one clause, free exercise clause, fits all religious freedom cases approach, was refreshing. And I just wish it had more than a couple of votes on the court.
It was definitely more in keeping with the cases that we've seen through the decades to recognize that there is this room for play in the joints. That's the term the court has used to say that there are things that you can do in this area of religious freedom that are not required. And that's sort of, we think about permissive accommodations for religion. And we also think about permissive protections that states could have to keep them out of the religion business. But this decision really does narrow that play in the joint, saying that at least you start from the assumption that under the free exercise clause, any different treatment is going to be looked at as discriminatory and presumptively violating the free exercise clause.
I also appreciated how both Justice Breyer and Justice Sotomayor talk about history. I think more complete view of the history that includes the founding generation and talks about some of their motivations for disestablishment and having no aid provisions way back as far back as 1786 in Virginia. But Holly, you had the opportunity to submit some analysis for SCOTUS blog. SCOTUS blog often has a symposium after big cases like this one where they ask a number of leading experts in the field to write their reflections on the case. And you submitted a great piece and just thought it would be interesting for our listeners for you to walk through some of your big takeaways from the case and the larger context of what this case means for vouchers and state constitutions and the impact of this holding plus Trinity Lutheran.
Yeah, as we've already noted, I mean, it's a loss. This case we found, you know, to be particularly bothersome and disturbing in the way they first, the majority did not find that religious liberty interests deserve much attention in their decision. And as you noted, the concurrence even less so. But there are two things that the court did that arguably narrow the impact, but a lot remains to be seen about what happens in the next cases. And the two things that I focused on in my SCOTUS blog piece is, one, the court maintained this idea that there might be a distinction between treating a religious entity different based upon its status and treating it differently based upon its use. In other words, because the majority opinion says that Montana cannot have this tax credit program because it automatically excludes religious schools, that was enough for the decision. That was enough for the majority decision. They did not answer the question about what would its decision be if Montana was treating a religious use differently, like if the money was more targeted toward explicitly religious education. It's pretty confusing because, as Justice Breyer goes through quite clearly in the dissent, the case came up because religious parents wanted to send their kids to a religious school for religious reasons to, you know, have a religious education woven throughout their educational experience. So the court leaves that open, but doesn't give us much confidence that it will make a distinction if a state is trying to avoid using its resources for religious uses. But the other point that I wanted to drive home, which is very significant, is that toward the end of the majority opinion, Chief Justice Roberts writes very clearly that, quote, a state need not subsidize private education, but once a state decides to do so, it cannot disqualify some private schools solely because they are religious, close quote. So there he really is beefing up this status use distinction and making clear that the program at issue was one that already provided aid to private schools. And so what that tells us as defenders of religious liberty, as people who don't want the government to be involved in religion, to be advancing and paying for different religious uses, is that we need to work hard to preserve public funds for public schools and public uses. Montana's downfall in this case is because it created a tax credit program like this that incentivized giving to private education. You know, we could have a whole nother podcast on why would a state do that, and trying to figure out what the motives are. Maybe we could find that in the political or legislative record. But I think this is a clear warning to state legislatures and policymakers that anytime they are diverting public resources toward private education, it's going to get them involved in this area of funding religion.
Yeah, I centered in on that piece two, which comes, as you pointed out in your SCOTUS blog piece, pretty late in the decision. I think page 20 of it, of 22-page opinion from Chief Justice Roberts, that, you know, that doesn't require, he says, you know, you're not required to subsidize private education, but once you set it up, you can't draw a distinction between secular private schools and religious private schools. So in some ways it can be limiting, but then Justice Breyer really challenges that in his dissenting opinion. And he's picking up here on some of his questioning from oral argument that caught our attention at the time, that he says, well, where do you draw the line? If I'm quoting from him here, if making scholarships available to only secular non-public schools exerts, quote, coercive pressure on parents whose faith impels them to enroll their children in religious schools, then how is the state's decision to fund only secular public schools any less coercive? I mean, he's basically saying, where do you draw the line here if you're making a distinction based on what a state's public policy position might be on public schools? Then he goes on to ask about charter schools. How would the majority's rule distinguish between those states in which support for charter schools is akin to public school funding and those in which it triggers a constitutional obligation to fund private religious schools? I think he's pointing out here in a very policy-based way, you know, where is the line and how much of this are we really seeing as a, you know, a way to really shift support from public schools into the private realm?
I think that's right. And I think that that is a warning to those who want to continue to reserve public funds for public education and public resources, and those like us who don't want to see the government involved in religious practices and religious education, that, you know, you have to be clear to fight hard and draw these distinct lines. I think the next battle we'll see will be now that states know that they can easily be required, if they fund any kind of private education, through any kind of program, that they'd be required to extend that to religious schools, that we might see legislation that will say anytime tax dollars are spent in education, maybe certain accountability strings attach. And here would be a good time to note some of the differences about religious education, right? One thing that is absent from the court's opinion, as it says that the free exercise clause prohibits this different treatment of religion, is the recognition of the different ways that religious schools operate. And just to name a few, many religious schools have different admission criteria. Unlike the public schools, they can apply a religious test for admission. They might require church attendance or some kind of religious recommendation, a signing of a statement of faith. They can have different hiring practices, and we'll learn more about that in the decisions about how far the ministerial exception goes. But they can hire teachers who also have to sign a statement of faith. They have different curriculum standards, obviously, in order to inculcate religion. They can, you know, teaching religious principles. So in many ways, religious schools are treated differently under state laws. And now that they will, in many cases, be able to tap into state funds, there will be a greater spotlight on those differences. And I'm sure there'll be some effort to apply different standards of non-discrimination, fairness, and accountability to those schools that we haven't seen before. Many of the justices, whether it's Breyer in dissent or if it was Justice Alito during oral argument in the ministerial exception cases, have recognized the way that religion is so important to religious schools, and that people send their kids to religious school because they want a religious education. And it's going to be difficult, and we'll see if some cases can address it clearly, but it's going to be difficult to separate that religious use in an educational setting from the religious status, which is the basis of this decision we have from the majority here. And Justice Gorsuch gets into that point.
Yeah, which really gets back to your first point that you made in the SCOTUS blog argument here, but distinguishing the court's Chief Justice Roberts really continuing trying to distinguish between status and use. And we saw some disagreement on that point, not only from the dissent, but also from one of the concurrences, from Justice Gorsuch's concurrence, who really draws into question whether you can separate that. As you called it in your piece, it really is more of a shell game to try to focus on character or status as opposed to use here. And so again, while we can hang on to that piece, that Chief Justice Roberts does not seem quite ready to say that public money can fund religious uses, it's difficult to see, as applied here in this case, that there's much of a difference. Well, thanks, Holly, for that analysis of this important decision, and also for writing a really cogent and clear analysis of the opinion for SCOTUS blog and the company of a number of other experts, people who agreed with the court's opinion, people like us who did not, and talk about some of the implications, what some of the implications might be for the future, not just for church-state cases, but also in the field of education policy.
That's right. And we know from the quick reaction to this case that there will be a big push toward more privatization of public education, for more tax dollars going to private religious education. We know that because there was an immediate statement from Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos as soon as the decision came out, hailing the historic victory for America's students and calling on all states to take advantage of this opportunity to expand their voucher programs.
Not only all states, but the Trump administration is also, we have reports, going to ask Congress to include new grants available for religious schools, as well as a new tax credit program, much larger than the one at issue in Montana, to push through a federal tax credit for similar education scholarships. Not only that, but asking Congress to attach it to COVID-19 relief legislation. So Trump administration, Secretary DeVos, not wasting any time in trying to use this decision to push a privatization agenda.
Well, we certainly have our work cut out for us, and we will continue to fight for faith freedom for all by supporting public schools that serve all students without regard to religion. And we will continue to fight government efforts that would fund direct religious activity.
That's right. And we are going to continue to stand up for the distinctiveness of religion and know that sometimes when government treats religion differently, it's not discriminatory. It shows respect for religion and the special place it holds in our society. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about where else we've seen religion respected in the world around us this week. So in this final segment of Respecting Religion, we talk about what else other than Supreme Court opinions we are reading or thinking or talking about these days. And honestly, Holly, I'm reading a lot more articles in the newspaper about COVID-19 and really alarmed about how numbers are going up. We're seeing record numbers almost daily now of new cases. It's really concerning. And particularly in my home state of Texas, I'm watching that news with a lot of concern, and, you know, just looking for some hopeful places in a time when we have a lot of uncertainty about what the future holds. Again, this is kind of back to where we were several weeks ago.
Yeah, the news does not seem to be getting better. We've taken some steps backward, and we're continuing to look at how we can open up more. At the same time, we're being told to pull back because the infection rates still go up. In trying to navigate all of the news and to stay healthy and to figure out kind of how best to respond to this, my eyes have been on the school year ahead, as most parents are. And, you know, I don't have the little ones at home that you have, Amanda, but I am, you know, completely concerned about those with young children and the need to get back to school. At least we have seen, as people focus on trying to get kids back in school, this week in the news saw some hopeful messages from young people. Did you see that CNN article focused on college students and how they were preparing?
Yeah, and we'll put a link in show notes. The title is Finding God in the Unlikeliest of Places. And CNN has reflections from five young people of different religious backgrounds and talking about where they have seen their faith respected or how they've grown in their faith or relied on their faith in this time. And I found a lot of inspiration in these college students and divinity students and what they were what they were doing with their face and how they were relying on it.
Yeah, it was nice to have that personal, individual expression of religion to focus on. That was refreshing as we continue to grapple with the big questions of how communities of faith are going to continue and how they're going to change. It was nice to see respectful treatment of different religious traditions and how they play out in individual lives during this time. And that reminds me of another really nice feature of some young people in the news, and in that NPR story that had the descendants of Frederick Douglass. Did you see that, Amanda?
Yeah. So NPR put this short film together, really, of these young people, teenagers up to early 20s, reading portions of his famous speech, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July." This was just a really fitting piece, I thought, reflection for this 4th of July, as we are in this national reckoning for racism and racial justice in our country, when we are looking at our history with new eyes, with a more honest look at inclusion and what it means to be an American. I found this to be one of the most patriotic things I did this 4th of July, to watch this short video.
I agree. I recommend that our listeners take a look at that, and I think they'll see why we both enjoyed it, especially after the recitation when these kids reflect on what's important about this now. And you'll see that theme of hope and hopefulness that is so important to help us move forward. It's amazing to think about how Frederick Douglass made that clear at the time, living at much more difficult times than we're in now. He still believed in the ideas and remained hopeful about our country. And so I think that all of our listeners would enjoy seeing that, listening to that, and taking a minute for a little bit of hope now.
That brings us to the close of this episode of Respecting Religion. Thanks for inviting us into your home or earbuds during this time of social distancing. Check out our show notes for links to the articles we mentioned today.
And tune in again next week. We'll be back with a new episode on Thursday. You can see a list of all our episodes for this series on our website. Visit bjconline.org/respectingreligion. And be sure to subscribe to the BJC podcast. We're on all the major platforms.
Let us know what you think of the show on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BJC on the Hill, and you can follow me on Twitter at Amanda Tyler BJC. And get to know us. Visit our website at bjconline.org to see how we've been working for faith, freedom for all since 1936.
And join us again next week for a new conversation, Respecting Religion.